Welcome to Managing Uncertainty, a podcast series from the experts at BrightPath discussing global risk, business continuity, and crisis management. Will you be ready to lead your organization through its critical moment?
Hello and welcome to the Managing Uncertainty podcast. This is Brian Strauser, Principal and CEO here at BrightPath.
Hi, this is Bray Wheeler, Consultant at BrightPath.
And this is our weekly broadcast edition of the Managing Uncertainty podcast, where we break down two or three interesting developments around the world and talk about what that may or could mean for the private sector and other organizations. This week, we're going to start off by talking yet again about developments in the city of Hong Kong.
Again.
Hong Kong, the special administrative region of China, continues to have disruption. We've now evolved today. We're recording this podcast on Monday, August 5th. Today, there was a general strike in Hong Kong that paralyzed transportation networks during rush hour, forced the cancellation of hundreds of flights, and shut down scores of business and restaurants after another chaotic weekend of protests across several parts of the city. It's interesting now that this is evolving from protests to a general strike, which I think portends a much more difficult path for the Hong Kong government and the Chinese government, for that matter. And the demonstrators are getting more savvy. They're using tactics deliberately to outsmart the police. Yeah. They're using lasers and lights in order to disrupt facial recognition.
Yeah, that was one example. That was a big concern here kind of over the last week, that they were afraid they weren't going to be able to make much more progress in terms of the protest based on the fact that China was going to use this facial recognition to start rounding
identify
folks up.
People. Yeah. So it looks like tens of thousands of people participated in the protest, including airline pilots, airline crews, baggage handlers, bus drivers, financial planners, and others who declined to show up to work. In fact, transportation networks, the train system primarily, train and bus system across Hong Kong, which is normally quite efficient in the financial hub, were suspended or delayed, including the airport express train that links downtown Hong Kong to the airport. And more than 200 flights were delayed or canceled at Hong Kong's international airport. The protests have now been going on since June. And I think they've solidified now on kind of what their demands are. They're demanding the complete withdrawal of the current suspended bill that started this, the bill that allowed extradition to mainland China for trial of individuals that were arrested in Hong Kong. They want the resignation of Hong Kong's chief executive. They want an independent investigation of the police. And they want the protesters that have been arrested and charged with crimes, fake crimes as they're describing them, to be freed. Or the charges dropped. I think, I'm not sure they're still in jail.
Just a couple of demands.
Just a few demands, which I think are probably going to get ignored by the mainland Chinese government. So does our recommendation change? I mean, our recommendation has really been about monitoring what's going on.
Yep.
What do you think companies should be looking at now, Bray?
Well, I think right now we're starting to see that, you know, these protesters are making a much more impactful impact on life in Hong Kong. So being able to shut down transportation, being able to shut down the markets within Hong Kong are some pretty major steps in terms of disruption. And the fact that they are escalating and not de-escalating, as many thought probably may happen over the last week or two, just from a sustainment standpoint, that's not taking place. If anything, they're escalating this pretty substantially in terms of disruptions to businesses. So again, not much is changing in terms of probably our recommendations for businesses other than to continue to monitor. But I think if you haven't had discussions around continuity planning, around
travel safety,
yeah, those conversations need to start taking place probably sooner rather than later.
I mean, there's a potentially a very disruptive situation that can happen here. And you and I have experienced this in other countries where there has been political strife. We saw general strikes in parts of India. We saw significant strikes and protests of different type, both peaceful and violent, during the Arab Spring of 2011.
Yep.
I mean, we've seen this before where literally the city or state can shut down. And given the number of financial institutions and businesses that use Hong Kong as their Asia headquarters, Asia base, in a lot of cases, this may change the calculus of what that's going to look like in the future.
Well, even as a transportation hub for the region and being able to get in and out of that airport, I mean, that's going to have impacts even if you don't have business based directly in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really use that as a hub anymore.
Mm-hmm. I note that the Chinese military commander for Hong Kong said that the, where was his quote? The top military official, China's top military official in Hong Kong, according to this Reuters report, called the protests absolutely intolerable and made that statement alongside releasing video of the Chinese army conducting anti-riot drills in downtown Hong Kong.
So protesters thought the police were a problem. PLA.
The PLA is a significant problem. And that's for those of you that haven't been to Hong Kong, they literally are in a garrison right downtown on the water in the financial district. It is impossible to miss because there are gigantic Chinese flags. It's the only place you really see that. And it's right there. It's been there since they took over from the British that the PLA was going to, I believe it was the old British garrison that they're in.
Yeah.
British Army garrison.
Well, and it's what we need to expect here more than likely is that given the complications of all sorts of other things that are happening and not trying to make kind of direct connections, but given the fact that Hong Kong is in an uprising over democracy, really their position on it, the trade war with the U.S., those contentions, a lot of this kind of atmosphere and dynamic that's going on right now compounds kind of China's ability and some of their calculus in terms of what they're going to do next. They're probably not too worried about other countries getting involved necessarily if we've escalated this up with trade wars and other things. So There's a little bit of that dynamic at play too, that just the environment of what's happening here, it's less in control than it has been, you know, even when these first started, that the calculus has changed a little bit. So there's a little bit more uncertainty out there.
And I'm not sure what the answer is. I mean, where will this go in the long run? As we've talked previously, China's history for dealing with internal disruption is not pretty.
No.
These protests are on the scale or bigger than what happened in Tiananmen Square. I think that was 1989, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
These are beyond that in terms of scale, and they're happening in a city where press censorship is much more difficult than what they did in Beijing in 89 when they decided to act on the student protests.
Well, and even some of their more remote regions that they've kind of asserted their control over, different rebellions and uprisings that they've seen. Hong Kong, to your point, it's a very different animal in terms of that freedom of press, that exposure to the international scene. People are seeing it. You can't get away from it from a global standpoint. And so they have to assert themselves probably at some point. How they're going to choose to do that given that exposure, I think to your point, we just don't know yet.
I mean, I'm not sure what the path is going to be. I think there might be a middle ground here if China picks a new chief executive and the new chief executive comes in and just withdraws the previous law and calls it a day.
Yeah.
And does it end or does it continue? I could see that being a move that China makes, because they could brush it off as ineffective leadership by Carrie Lam. And so we're going to dump her and we're going to pick a new chief executive.
Yep.
And then make that play. That's not, China's done this before in the aftermath of Tiananmen, where they made major changes to the successors of the regime at the time because they were opposed to that action. So they deposed them.
Yep. The party will always survive.
The party will survive.
So it's just a matter of who's going to take the blame for it. Yeah, I mean, that scenario is entirely possible given they're kind of demonstrating some of their strong arm tactics and kind of their rhetoric, that to be able to back off and find a happy medium, you know, in terms of making those leadership changes and kind of hopefully settling it out and then addressing their issues later on, a few years from now, year from now, something like that, through new legislation or new politics. So the second item we have this week just kind of happened also today, on Monday. India revoked Kashmir's special status. So why that's important here. So Kashmir is kind of a long contested region between India and Pakistan primarily. China's also has a little bit of an involvement there, but it's only India's only Muslim kind of majority state. And so there's some difficulties from that standpoint as well. But Kashmir, once India and Pakistan won kind of their independence from Britain in 1947, they ended up dividing Kashmir kind of as an independent area kind of between the nations. India has since kind of asserted some more direct control through constitutional and different deals. But given that, and which kind of forms the basis for that special status. So the fact that they've revoked that special status is a pretty big deal, and it's a little bit unprecedented. They've kind of toyed with it in the past. They've suggested some different things in the past that were kind of around that, but never made this direct move. And why this is important is a couple fold. So probably from the international community, Kashmir doesn't have a whole lot of kind of impact on global economics. But from their relationship with Pakistan and probably a little bit with China, this is a big deal. Pakistan has already made indications that they're pretty outraged about it. This is a pretty direct kind of move by India in that region. There's often been skirmishes, there's been battles, there's been troop movements, things like that in Kashmir. It's a very contested zone. But for India to take this kind of dramatic step and contest control of that area directly is probably not only incites kind of internal politics within India, but also kind of outrages Pakistan. And the fact that they're so close to each other and just they're given their history, we don't know where this leads.
So for those of you that don't know the history, of course, when India became independent, Pakistan also became independent. It was part of India for forever, but it really spun off because Pakistan was made up for the most part the Muslim majority provinces or states, yep, of India, with the exception of Kashmir. Kashmir is India's only Muslim majority state, and its proximity to Pakistan has always been in dispute since their separation in 1947. And the fight over Kashmir, which has always been more of a cold fight with a few hot spots on a monthly basis thrown in there, yeah, as in they like to lob artillery at each other regularly.
Suicide attacks. Troop movements.
Some troop movement. Look, India has committed aggressive acts against Pakistan. Pakistan's committed aggressive acts against India. It all happens in and around Kashmir for the most part. It's nothing unusual. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like they all of a sudden they just looked at this tinderbox and said, well, let's throw a match in it and see what happens. I mean, this is really controversial.
Yeah.
It's controversial within India's parliament, where the representatives from the two impacted states, in one case, they're taking the state's actual government away and making it an arm of the central government, right? And the other one, they're telling them that they've lost their autonomy, their special autonomy status that they had. It's an interesting one. And I don't know, would this have happened under a different prime minister?
Maybe, maybe not. I think probably what we're seeing here is this is, again, I think we've talked about this a few podcasts ago. India's kind of assertion of their power in the region kind of leads here a little bit. This is kind of another move by India to kind of make some noise, make some hay, assert their kind of control and their power. They're kind of flexing their muscles a little bit with this because Pakistan can't directly stop this, right, decision. And the fact that Pakistan and the U.S. met within the last week or so, India's kind of reasserting themselves that, because Pakistan had asked the U.S. to kind of help mediate between the two countries regarding Kashmir. U.S. and China have obviously had some stuff over the last couple of weeks. India is now making a little bit of a kind of a power move to just get in the game and kind of assert themselves. This is really kind of my view on this move. is really to kind of take a step and say, yeah, we're not forgotten here. We're making a move.
How much of this, the reason I asked the question about like, would this have happened under a previous prime minister? This move kind of fits with Modi's approach.
Yeah.
As a Hindu nationalist, he has been unafraid to make decisions based upon India's Hindu majority population.
Correct.
And this kind of fits in that mold from the standpoint that he's stripping this autonomy from a region that is not a Hindu majority. In fact, it's a Muslim majority population.
Yep.
And a lot of the Hindus, because of because of history of India, the India-Pakistan independence movement, the two religions and its adherents don't necessarily trust each other.
Yep.
Inside of India. And the central government hasn't always done a good job of respecting that difference of religious view either.
No, and that leads a little bit to the some of what they've given as explanations for this move, you know, in terms of terrorism and Muslim attacks within Kashmir and kind of the contested area that aligns with kind of Modi's MO around that and kind of taking some direct stances against that. So that's one of the reasons they've given for this. But I mean, really, for companies right now, this is a thing to watch, especially if you have business within India, especially if you have business within some of those areas, you know, along the coast in between Pakistan and India. We've seen terrorism attacks in the past within India. It's not out of the question for, you know, groups within Pakistan, not necessarily affiliated directly with Pakistan. Some are, that it is possible for this to get out of control pretty quick, depending on kind of where this goes over the next 48 to 72 hours, kind of Pakistan's response. Now, Pakistan has obviously appealed to the UN because it's in violation of some of the UN resolutions and kind of deals that have been struck. So Pakistan is kind of making all the right moves politically to set themselves up as aggrieved, but that's not going to stop some of these groups from potentially kind of exercising their more aggressive tendencies. So that's not to say, you know, it's doom and gloom that it's going to happen, but companies definitely need to start kind of paying attention to this and preparing for the fact that, you know, this could go sideways pretty quick. As we've talked about, this is a pretty unprecedented step for India.
I would go as far as to say that unless your company specifically has business operations in Kashmir, if to your travelers or expatriates that are in India, I would make Kashmir off limits to them.
Yeah.
It's there's too much risk of conflict, and you're suddenly going to find yourselves in a situation where you've got a couple travelers who wanted to see Kashmir because it's beautiful, and they're out there and an artillery barrage starts. There's not a lot you're going to be able to do at that point in time to guarantee their safety, to ensure their safety.
Yep. That's one of those regions in the world where
it's not beautiful to be there.
It's beautiful for a reason. It's
best not to be there.
It's like the Korean demilitarized zone. It's beautiful for a reason. You know, there's guns pointed on both sides.
So I think our last story for this episode is about Iran's seizure of yet another tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. Bray, what's the story there?
So Iran has taken a couple steps here in the last kind of few days. They've claimed they've seized another oil tanker, which they say is smuggling oil through the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf. And they're kind of elevating their presence as a security force to guarantee kind of tanker safety and maritime safety within the region, all of which is a little bit fuzzy because they're the ones taking tankers. However, this kind of demonstrates that they really haven't backed off and they're not backing off. If anything, they're continuing to kind of elevate their posture with some of that. They've also made some pretty kind of direct comments at European powers here today as well in terms of the kind of nuclear deal. And their kind of escalation of, unless we can work something out between Iran and Europe, for the U.S. kind of backing out of the agreement, they're going to start kind of elevating their production of nuclear materials, heavy water, uranium, plutonium, et cetera. There's really not much Europe can do about that because US has kind of led the charge on that. So there's only so much Europe can do. So it kind of fits in the mold of what kind of Iran's been doing of kind of escalating tensions there in the area.
There's been a lot of discussion about some type of maritime security alliance in the Gulf, through the Strait of Hormuz, where I believe initially this was kind of this has bounced around a little bit in the last 2 weeks, but initially the United States talked about it, and no one wanted to play with us, primarily because of the current administration's foreign policy approach, the president's foreign policy approach. So then it became, well, the UK can lead a maritime security alliance in the Strait of Hormuz. The Brits approached the French and the Germans, who said no. So now this appears to be coming back or headed back towards a UK-US, which means probably Canada, New Zealand, and Australia will come along and play
right
for this. There was an interesting piece related to this whole issue on the U.S. Naval Institute blog, kind of the think tank that looks at maritime issues from a U.S. perspective, where a retired U.S. naval officer made a long argument why the data shows that the Brits, the Royal Navy, can essentially not project enough power to do this on their own. Yep. They have one destroyer, as I understand, or a cruiser in the Persian Gulf.
It's limited.
And that's what they can do. And he really kind of took to task the Brits for some of their defense decisions when it comes to the Navy. And I'm just going to read the end because I thought it was an interesting and insightful view. That alliances at sea are tender devices. Everyone's relearning today a lesson that will be eternal for any nation's naval forces. Friends are nice to have, but they're often fleeting. And you need to be prepared to fight alone or just go home. Design your nation's navy accordingly. And I think the Brits are in a situation where they simply can't project enough power to protect their shipping.
They can't.
In that area. They have other ships who are committed elsewhere. So I think in the end, this is going to come down to, can the Brits and the U.S. and perhaps some of the Commonwealth countries, the Five Eyes, figure out how we can do this together? And of course, we have the challenges of our president's current lack of relationships on the international front probably complicate this, because there's no personal diplomacy to be had to build that alliance.
Well, and this all stems somewhat back to the nuclear deal and the U.S.'s decision to
blow it up,
to pull out of it. So it's kind of forced Europe into a box, particularly the U.K., because they're one of the kind of the major parties of that. UK, again, doesn't have the force projection in the Strait of Hormuz to continue to do it. The US has indicated that, well, it's British tankers, it's kind of your problem. There's a reluctance to necessarily probably on our end to get super involved from a US standpoint, just based on everything else that's going on, unless there's some kind of like direct confrontation that would kind of force our hand in a different way. It's just this situation in particular is, again, like we've seen with Hong Kong, isn't going away anytime soon. There's not a magic answer here.
No, there's not. And there's a very deliberate effort. I mean, you have to kind of take a step back and look at who benefits from all of this.
Right.
There's a very deliberate effort underway with Iran's approach, having the JPOA pulled by the United States. What Iran is trying to do is they see the personality split in the NATO alliance, in the Great Atlantic alliances, between the U.S. and others in Europe. They see the split between President Trump and the European leaders, and they're trying to drive a wedge through that by continuing to separate the United States from its traditional allies, because in the end, that just benefits them.
Right.
They know they can't win. They don't want a war, a shooting war. They know they can't win in a head-on conflict between themselves and the NATO powers, and no one's going to back their play. So they're just they're trying to divide us. They're trying to separate these traditional alliances through this irregular warfare. And Iran is the expert, the modern day expert in irregular warfare. They've been doing it with Hamas and Hezbollah, with Israel and Lebanon all along.
Yep.
Right. They know how to play that game better than anybody on that end of the spectrum. So that's the challenge.
Yeah.
The foreign policy, national security challenge anyway. The corporate challenge is it's just a very unsafe situation.
Well, I think that's kind of the general theme in particular with these three topics this week, is it just an indication of the changing dynamic of the U.S. foreign policy influence kind of in the global community and what's happening and people's desire or courage to take some different steps that they may not have taken in the past? You know, would Iran have done this 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Maybe, maybe not, depending on the situation. But, you know, there's definitely an environment out there that they feel pretty willing to try and take some pretty overt moves in terms of, to your point, driving the wedge. Mm-hmm. And finding those cracks in the policies and just pushing enough that they continue to kind of get away with what they want to get away with.
Mm-hmm. And I think this poses the, to me, this is this poses the bigger national security and private sector challenge, is that certainly there's the potential for great power conflict between the United States and China or Russia. And we are dealing with that in some different ways that we've talked about here before with Taiwan and Hong Kong and elsewhere. I still think it's the irregular warfare situation that's driven by really Iran is the last big player in this area, but certainly the terrorist groups fit in here. I mean, this was ISIS's approach and Al-Qaeda's approach and AQAP's approach in Yemen, in Somalia, and Ethiopia, Djibouti, you know, and things that we still see happening. But I think that this is the threat. It's not going to be the great naval and air war between the U.S. and China. It's going to be, how do we continue to deal with the irregular warfare set in the Middle East and elsewhere, Horn of Africa, that caused these issues?
One, just the unstable environments that arise, that pop up, that are stoked by different nations trying to unsettle things. And so private sector, certainly from the U.S. and from other kind of Western European origins, you're having to change. You're starting to see a change in the writing on the wall, whatever cliche you want to insert there, that your business as usual is evolving. Mm-hmm. And probably in a way that is going to be kind of a slow burn until all of a sudden, in a spot you were pretty comfortable in is no longer comfortable. And it's popped up not because of kind of armed conflict even. It could just be what we're seeing in Hong Kong or kind of heightened tensions with Kashmir or kind of disruption with economic trade like we're seeing in the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, all these things are kind of little slow burns that all of a sudden change the dynamic and you're operating in a different way. And if you're not thinking about that and you're not paying attention to those things, you're going to get caught.
Well, I think this kind of takes us to another pivot that's going on. I don't think we've recognized it for what it is yet. But if you think about the last 20 years, starting with, you know, September 10th and what we thought was the challenge from a national security and private sector perspective and how the next day changed all of that, right? So we woke up on September 12th, 2001, and we spent the next couple of years figuring out the new rule sets, right?
Yep.
Everything had changed. Business resiliency suddenly became a real thing because 9/11 made it much more real to a lot of people and companies than before. Then you saw the pivot in the kind of counterinsurgency and the rise of irregular warfare in the Middle East driven by the United States efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq, what that meant for surrounding areas. And now I think we're on the next pivot. And the pivot is now it's Iran spinning much more publicly, much more visibly this web of issues that it's creating, and we still have those other irregular warfare things going on too that disrupt our world. Not to mention the active shooter incidents of this past weekend that changed the security posture of companies and mass gatherings and things along those lines.
Yep.
But that's a conversation for another day.
It is. We're not jumping in that one today.
So that's it for this edition of the Managing Uncertainty podcast, the Brightcast edition for the week of August 5th, 2019. We'll have more episodes coming soon. Hope to see you then. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Managing Uncertainty, produced by the experts at BrightPath. To receive notifications of new episodes, join our newsletter at brightpath.com or subscribe to your favorite podcast player, such as iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about the services and trusted advice from BrightPath by visiting brightpath.com. That's BrightPath.com.